eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Don't just ride the index. Seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Welcome to the Jill on Money Show. It's Saturday, March 23rd. Why does that date ring a bell to me? March 23rd is my buddy Deborah's birthday. But you know what else? I think that's where we may have made a bear market low 4 years ago in 2020. Yeah, I think that's right. Imagine that. Who would have known that in the middle of COVID that the market would then come roaring back? It just shows you it's impossible to time the market. I don't care. These folks who say they can beat the market, yeah, they might beat the market in a given year, but they're not going to do it over and over and over. And you're not going to be able to pick the person who could do it even a few times. So you know what? That's why we stick to a very boring mantra here, which is just let us know what's going on in your life, and we'll figure out the least difficult way for you to get where you want to go. And if you want some help with that, just go to our website, jillonmoney.com, and click the Contact Us button. Today and tomorrow, we've got an interview with a pal of mine, Anat Admati. And boy, is she credentialed. She is the George G.C. Parker Professor of Finance and Economics at Stanford Graduate School of Business. She's also the Director of Corporations and Society Initiative, Senior Fellow, Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. She is a super smart person. She also is the author of a book, and I interviewed her way back when, I think in 2013, when the book first came out, called The Banker's New Clothes. And Anat and her co-author have actually updated the book. And so we now have a revision that's just out this year, The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. It's the new and expanded edition, and it's in paperback. Here is the first part of my interview with Anat Admati. Let's go back in time and talk about why you originally wrote the book when it came out in 2013. We'd come out of this massive financial crisis, and you were writing a lot about this in newspapers and academic articles. But why did you feel like the book had to be written to begin with?
The book had to be written because the people who are managing the system, the people in it, wouldn't fix it unless the public, other people, the media understood better what was going on, and unless they had some political pressure to do it. There is just a lot of politics and conflicts of interest in banking, and the public is suffering. So the book had to be written to alert the public that they're not fixing the problem, despite a huge financial crisis, a huge recession, a huge housing crisis, all of that, and explain what's going on. At that point, I saw that some people don't understand what's going on and are just confused, and some people don't want to understand what's going on because it works for them.
Well, I mean, I was going to say there's a certain amount of willfulness when it comes to the banks. So I just want to bring everybody back in time. You know, 15 years ago, we had a pretty close to the edge financial calamity. And when we look back on that time, if we look back to 2008 and we see all of these banks in this precarious situation, we saw that there was a real failure of regulation and rules in place to protect the system, which then required a humongous bailout by taxpayers. So now we come out of that, and we are supposedly given a bunch of regulations. What did those regulations purport to do, and what have they actually done?
The law that was passed in the U.S. was called the Dodd-Frank Act, signed in summer 2010. And it was a massive piece of regulation that in some cases recycled existing rules that were always there in banking, enabling the supervisors and regulators to kind of keep the banking system safe. And it took on a few other things that supposedly would need to be fixed about money market funds, about credit rating agencies, about derivative trading, all kinds of things that were seen as very fragile in the crisis. What it did deliver is not very much. The rules are incredibly complicated and almost way too complicated, but they failed to do the most basic of things to keep the system safe, which is what basically I realized in 2010, 11, 12, that led to the writing of this book. And it, as you said, I started with just trying to talk to the policymakers, trying to understand what was going on, trying to listen to what people are saying. And none of it made sense to me. And it's just, we hit a wall if we're going to fight it out on op-ed pages or occasional policy comments. It required either teaching the material or giving up. So what did the regulation do? Very little, actually. They changed very little. They pretend to have done more than they did do. They'll tell you all the amazing things they did.
Okay, so let's talk about that. What did they fail to do that should be done to address the risk of the system?
Okay, so the thing we focus on, which is sort of the most no-brainer part of it, which is so infuriating they can't seem to get done, is the following. When you buy a house, you take a mortgage, right? And you pay a little money down payment. Okay, that's your equity portion of the house. Now, obviously, before the financial crisis, a lot of subprime loans were made with very little equity and all kinds of, but a lot of loans were given to a lot of people who really couldn't pay them. And so then the housing prices went down. The rest is history in terms of the housing crisis. Now, talk about banks and how they fund themselves. Okay. Most corporations can raise money in all kinds of ways. They can go to the stock market. They can have venture capitalists if they're a startup. And they can borrow. Okay. Corporations can take loans, can issue bonds and all of that. Now, the banks are funding themselves almost exclusively with money that they borrow, money that they promise to pay back. First and foremost, the ones that take deposits, which is a lot of them, to all of us who give the money in deposits. Now, we don't view ourselves as the creditors of the bank. We count on the money being there. It's now nominally insured, at least part of it. In fact, right now, it seems like all of it is always insured because they always spring back to kind of, you know, bail everybody out. And then they just build on top of that, debt upon debt upon debt, which is sort of, you know, as a finance professor, and I have written papers understanding their incentives to do that. But as a result, they end up being really, really, really unhealthy corporations. Corporations of the type you never find with no regulation anywhere in the economy. It's already telling you it's not healthy for a corporation to live on, you know, 95% debt, or in fact, to show the symptoms of, you know, being underwater, being insolvent, being a zombie all the time and hiding it, but not defaulting. If they don't default because they always have, you know, the Fed to go to or deposit insurance and depositors are keeping their money, then nobody will know that they are actual insolvent or close to insolvency all the time. And all of a sudden, we might see it. And that's what happened with Silicon Valley Bank in last spring, because all of a sudden, we saw how awfully designed and how incredibly ineffective the rules were. And all of a sudden, there was a big run and there was a big bailout. And now there's more bailouts of all the banks. And there's the New York Community Bank now teetering. And so they're trying to kind of make us not look there. But the system has remained incredibly fragile and incredibly layered and opaque with a lot of debt chains that make it very fragile.
So I want to understand one thing. I think people hear liquidity and solvency. Can you explain the difference between those two concepts when it comes to banking?
I'm so glad you asked that. So the perennial narrative in banking is it's always in the plumbing. It's always the liquidity. Now, what is a liquidity problem? It's very simple. If I promise to pay you cash at, 11 p.m. tonight, and I forgot to go to the ATM and get cash, I may not pay you cash, but I may have a large bank account and, the ATM is far away or whatever, or before ATMs, I wouldn't go to the bank, before it opened. In other words, liquidity is about your ability to convert your assets to cash at the appropriate time that you owe something. Okay, so that's a liquidity. In general, liquidity of assets is the ability to convert them to cash or to a certain amount of cash. So a house might not be liquid, can take a while to sell it. So that's a liquidity issue. Okay, especially if you owe money, then you need to pay cash. Otherwise, you have to settle with a lender how you're going to pay. So the banks, because they take deposits and depositors can come anytime, and because they're so indebted with short-term debt that can just decide not to renew the loan, like, it would be an overnight loan or a one-week loan, then they're prone to having liquidity problems, because if they have illiquid assets like mortgages, but of course they securitize them, they have a lot of liquid assets too, but, they'll have to, liquidate some of them to pay. So they would have a liquidity problem if, for example, everybody decided just on a clear blue day to run to the bank, like in the movies. People will suddenly decide that because of a rumor or because somebody else is doing it and they're afraid, they're running. Even though the bank has a lot of assets, it will have a liquidity problem. But long time ago, like a century ago, more, we solved those problems. We created institutions called central banks to be lender of last resort for the banks, or just give them open windows for them at the regional Fed to make sure they have cash in the ATM, to make sure they don't run into liquidity problems. And we also created deposit insurance so people don't run, at least if they have insured deposits, they can count on that if the bank doesn't pay them, then FDIC will pay them.
Let me interrupt you for a second. So yeah. Are those mechanisms the right ones? In other words, if I'm going to be a bank and I'm holding a mortgage, a 30-year mortgage, obviously people are making their payments, but I don't have all the money back. So is it smart to have a central banking system where it can address that liquidity problem? Is that the right mechanism?
Well, it's in the history of banking, the central banks were sort of, the bank's banks. And so the central banks are incredibly privileged because they can actually print money as much as they want. They're like a money forger legally, and of course they have to worry about inflation. But in principle, the central bank here, the Federal Reserve, which we now explain in detail how it works to any lay person, can grow its assets from $900 billion to $9 trillion because it just decided to lend and to buy assets, to have these QEs and all these other things. Anyway, you're asking me if it's the right setting. It is thought that it helps the economy function, that the banks, that everybody doesn't worries about their business and not about whether the bank is healthy or not. Then you need the regulators to do it instead of them. The central bank giving liquidity to private banks is hardly ever questioned. And we should be asking always, is this the right thing to do? Is this the right thing to do? I think coupled with proper regulations, it might be okay to do. But right now, the safety nets given to the banks themselves, allowing them to kind of always go play with depositors' money and take all kinds of risk and never worry about the downsides, have gotten out of control. And they're abusing that. They're exploiting that.
And you say that the financial system is currently dangerous and distorted. Can you explain that danger in a way that anyone listening to this can understand?
The financial system is supposed to make loan, allow investments, allow us to make payments, all of that. Along the way, it clips coupons all the time. Okay, so it's very profitable business, okay, on account of all of us. Now, but the way they do this is, as I started saying, they usually take the upside of the sort of magnified returns that come from doing what they're doing at scale and not have just basic, simple equity cushions from investors, like other companies have, to deal with losses. So small losses can take them down. Let's revisit Silicon Valley Bank, and we can, you know, First Republic, same things that happened last year. So that the distortion comes both from the excessive risk that they subject all of us to, and from them making investments that are not always in the best interest of the economy. It's both too much and too little in all kinds of ways, okay? And the regulation is part of what distorts what the decisions they make, because companies always, you know, make decision on the behalf of their shareholders, or, you know, they want to make money. In banks, when they want to make money, oftentimes it's not necessarily. I mean, we all can benefit sometimes, but oftentimes they have a lot of hidden ways to make money that make them benefit and the rest of us basically pay for it. So, for example, Silicon Valley Bank. What does Silicon Valley Bank do? The government during COVID and the central bank, the Fed, flooded the economy with cheap money. People got COVID supports, interest rates were zero, and Silicon Valley Bank, situated right where I am at Stanford right here, accumulated enormous amount of deposits. And eventually there was a little bit of slowdown and interest rates were beginning to go up. And it even before the interest rates went up, it invested a lot of it in what? In government bonds. Now, government bonds are supposed to be safe in the sense that they don't default. The government, you know, where there are some discussions of default sometimes, but let's just say the Treasurer of the United States has not defaulted on a promise yet. Every time when we have a budget crisis, they, you know, some people threaten that they will default, but that would be kind of the you know, that would be a cataclysmic event. So they haven't. So it's very safe that way. However, they promise a certain interest, which when interest rate. So when interest rates were very low, a 30-year loan to the government, which pays interest every 6 months, was, you know, was paying only like, I don't know, 1.5% long term, you know, like 30 year. But now interest rates got up to 4% and 5%. So an asset paying 1.5% is not worth as much when interest rates are 5%, because you want to get the 5% interest of, you know, the Federal Reserve now is paying the banks 5.4 when the bank deposit there. But the banks are not paying 5.4 to all of us who deposit with them as much. And then when they lend, they are charged a whole lot more. The point being that the banks have all kinds of incentives to put money on the sideline, or to take a lot of risk for it, or to lend it to the government, and not necessarily even to lend it to businesses at appropriate rate. Of course, if you want to regulate them, they're going to threaten that they won't make your loan or your loan and the American dream will be over. Let's leave the lobbying aside. What really distorts them are things like, you know, what happened was they invested in government bonds. Government bonds lost value, but the regulation was treating it as if there was no risk in investing in these long-term securities.
Now, hold on and one second. I just want you to pause for a second, because I don't think people get that. So when that was going down, when the Silicon Valley Bank was going down, someone asked me and said, well, I don't understand. How doesn't the San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank, which was supposed to be the main regulator of Silicon Valley Bank, why would they not have looked at SVB's balance sheet and said, oh, there's a mismatch here? What is it about the regulate? What could have happened, or what should the regulation be so that that's not allowed to happen, that mismatch?
Okay, so that's what the book is really about. If SVB had, you know, 20% equity funding, there wouldn't be a problem. The losses that they had, they would absorb like any company that, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. The shareholders, the equity is absorbing the losses when they happen, just like your value of your equity in the house goes down. But this is investments. You know, you take risks. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. If they took the risk that interest rates will go up on treasuries, then the treasuries interest rate did go up. The value of the treasuries went down. And therefore, they didn't have the assets to pay back, and they became insolvent. Now, the Fed, the regulators, the supervisors could have seen that this is banking 101, and the spectacular failure of them not to see it. And even in all these stresses that they do, not to even really play out a scenario that was playing out in front of us is outrageous, is what it is. There's no other way to describe it. It's outrageous. They totally dropped the ball, and the bank was insolvent like since the fall. And all of a sudden, it became apparent to everybody that it was, because they had to sell some of these treasuries and couldn't hide their losses anymore in accounting rules that allowed them to not adjust to fair value their holdings. We could pretend that the thing is still worth $1,000 when it's now actually worth $800, and they would report $1,000, and the regulators would somehow believe that.
That's so outrageous. Funny, but it's very funny because when you think about an individual investor, okay, let's say you have a margin account, you have borrowed money and you're investing, and every single day we are testing to see if people are in compliance, having enough equity capital at risk to justify the investment companies extending you a loan. But we don't do that with the nation's banks.
In the second part of our interview with Anat, what we're going to do is outline what should be done to correct these ills that still plague the banking sector. So you'll have to tune in tomorrow, but I'm very happy you tuned in today. Of course, if you have a question or a comment about this, go to JillOnMoney.com, click the Contact Us button, and let us know if you'd like to come on the air with us. Don't forget to sign up for the free weekly newsletter. We are getting tons and tons of people doing that, and we're so happy the subscription service Jill on Money Live keeps growing and thriving. And for $35, and you want to be part of that, we're going to call you guys the Jillionaires. Someone else made that up, not me. That was one of our viewers of our YouTube show called Jill on Money, powered by The Compound. In any event, we thank you so much for listening, and try to do something nice for someone else today. Change your work, change your wealth, change your life. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Do you know a high schooler who is a natural leader and loves to give back to their community? The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society's Student Visionaries of the Year program might be the perfect opportunity. Forming strong teams to support them, Student Visionaries of the Year candidates fundraise for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society in honor of a pediatric blood cancer survivor in their local community. This 7-week philanthropic leadership development program helps students gain valuable life skills like project management, communication, financial literacy, and entrepreneurship. Not to mention, it looks great on college applications. But most importantly, it's a chance for students to engage in meaningful work within their community and make a real impact on the lives of blood cancer patients and their families. Learn more about Student Visionaries of the Year or nominate a student at lls.org/students. That's lls.org/students.